This is a Day One podcast extra, bringing you a conversation between our host, Peter Wallace, and a special guest. For more information about Day One, which brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, visit our website at dayone.org.
Dr. Fred Craddock is on everybody's very short list of outstanding preachers of our time. Some years ago, Newsweek magazine called him one of America's top preachers, but we all here already knew that. Dr. Craddock is Minister Emeritus at Cherry Log Christian Church, Disciples of Christ in Cherry Log, Georgia. He is the Bandy Distinguished Professor of Preaching and New Testament Emeritus in the Candler School of Theology at Emory University. He has delivered numerous lectures in seminaries and spoken at conferences such as the Festival of Homiletics numerous times, written books and articles that have been so helpful to preachers. His CDs are available through CraddockSermons.com, and he is currently the director of the Craddock Center in Cherry Log, Georgia, and you can find out more about that at CraddockCenter.org. Dr. Craddock, we're delighted to speak to you today. Thank you for granting this interview for the Festival of Homiletics in Minneapolis, and we're delighted to know that you're planning to be at next year's festival in Atlanta. Looking forward
to
that.
Right.
The act of preaching has essentially not changed for millennia. Is the sermon still a relevant communications method today?
Well, I think so. I think nothing has actually replaced the human voice. A human voice in a room of ears and voices that might speak back is a vulnerability and a dynamic and a power that's still unmatched. I don't know of any substitute for it. If you have as many as two people, they're both vulnerable. They're enough different that they need to talk, but they're close enough together that they can talk. And in a context of worship and tradition and continuity, it's irreplaceable. There's no PowerPoint, no technology that can do quite that.
You've noted over the years that traditional preaching tends to be deductive, and you advocate a more inductive process. How would you distinguish those two approaches, and why is inductive better?
Well, the deductive, as I was taught it by the old Broadus Witherspoon textbook that everybody used, you start with an assumption that the word you speak is authoritative. So you start with a conclusion, and then you draw lessons from that conclusion. Now, where you got that conclusion may rest in your own authority, the authority of the church, the authority of Scripture, or just in the minds of the people who listen, who think you're an authority. But you start with a conclusion and then draw lessons from that. That's deductive. Inductive, you start with the particulars of a situation or a text and arrive at a conclusion. It asks more of the listener. The listener has to make the journey through the sermon and come to a conclusion. Now, induction is not 100% persuasive. It's the method of science. You examine 500,000 white mice, and they all have pink eyes. You still can't say all white mice have pink eyes. But you can draw a conclusion that is solid enough to live with and to live by. But I'm concerned about more responsibility on the part of the listener. A preacher, a pastor, has to stay with the congregation long enough for them to develop the muscle and the nerve, the audacity, to speak back, to respond, to go to little settings of conversation about the sermon, but in the sermon itself, to be able to complete sentences, to complete ideas, to make analogies, to be reminded of something you already know. That takes an activity that most congregations haven't yet really gotten into. Therefore, they say, well, now what was it you really were saying, if they're curious? Or they may want a copy of the sermon. But I think over a period of time, when they see you genuinely do want them to be partners in the process, they will do it and enjoy it and feel liberated by it. And by the way, begin to witness themselves as to what they've seen and heard. Instead of just being listeners, and if somebody has a question, call the minister, they are in a position to engage other people. When I began teaching preaching in the 60s, that was the age of the student revolution. And several things marked that 60s. One is all traditions and voices of authority have got to go. Take the pulpit and the pews out of the chapels and the sanctuaries. There's a short attention span. The human sensorium has changed. It once was for the ear, now it's for the eye. It's a visual age. The sermon, no more. But the short attention span has not really been proven to be true. If something is important and touches my life in an important way, I'll sit there a long time.
Friend, what do you hope happens when you preach? Should a preacher attempt to persuade the listener in some way or provide an experience? What do you hope happens?
Well, there are various ways to look at it. One thing you want to do in the sermon is have people revisit their own experiences, because they may have overlooked experiences with God and didn't have any word for it except coincidence or something like that. You might help them revisit their own lives. I don't think of experience as just the preacher examining his or her own heart and saying things about it. Too autobiographical, all there's room for some of that. But for the listener's experience, for me to know you as the listener, your social and economic location, your vocation, your family situation, the way you earn your money, if I know you, I know where your appetites are. If I am of the gospel, more or less, if I believe that, then I can say something that will connect with your present or past experience and open the door to your trusting there may be something in the future. Faith can move into hope at that point. So I'm not thinking of experience as trumping tradition. I believe strongly in the historic content of the faith. But there are places where it makes contact with your life. Otherwise, we're in the museum.
Is there a fundamental message that the preacher should continually try to share in their sermons?
Well, I think most preachers have really one sermon, one message, and everything is a spin-off or variation of that. The message I would say that's central is the grace of God. But grace can be said too easily. Some people preach grace to the point that there is really no justice or no merit or no work or no activity or no challenge. It's just kind of slimy, easy, and cheap. We have to remember, like in Stories of the Prodigal Son, there was an older brother who had a real good point. I've been here working all the time he was gone. The father had two sons. He loved both sons. He went out to both sons. But it's so easy just to kill off the older brother and wallow in the grace of the party for the prodigal that came home. There is tension in grace. There's tension, it seems to me, in the very nature of God. Shall I come down on the judgment of this evil, or shall I break the syllogism and forgive the person? All sinners are punished. Jim is a sinner. Jim is forgiven. You might fracture the syllogism, but you have to have some structure of justice. Otherwise, grace is just melted ice cream, you know.
How would you suggest preachers improve their delivery skills? That seems to be one of the issues that many preachers have. They may have great content, they may have the message that they want to get across, but the delivery skills are a little loose. What can they do to improve that?
We've suffered a loss in the church in that candidates for ministry go to seminary and have never had a speech course. and they may have a marvelous message, but they stand there counting their shoelaces and mumble, and nobody hears it. There are several things can be done. Is get a few sessions with a voice speaker, a teacher. Have some sessions with someone who reads well publicly, knows how to get you to lift the face and lift the voice, and not be timid about being heard. Always examine the equipment in the sanctuary to make sure it's working. You don't want to fight the furniture. You don't want to fight the microphone. You want it to be in good order so that no calories are burned wondering what's the matter with this. But just to feel strongly, to know what you're talking about, and be persuaded it's important, you're going to lift up your voice. Some of the timidity is a sort of capitulation of authority or the right to say anything in the room. So I whimper and whine around and make a few suggestions. I think part of the lack of delivery is in the lack of conviction and passion and knowing the subject for the day. No matter who walks in, archbishops or whatever, walks into the room, on that text, on that subject, on that day, you know more than anybody in the house. So turn it loose. It lies somewhere other than in just the throat or the eyes. But some training in that would be very, very important.
I know you do a lot of storytelling at the Craddock Center, which has become a center for storytelling. What do you think is more effective, a good story or a good sermon?
Well, that's a toughie. A good sermon, it seems to me, has a story-like quality to it. That is, it is a kind of narration. A good sermon gives you all along a sense of an ending. This is going somewhere. Well, that's true of a story. There are a lot of preachers who never tell stories but have the reputation of being good storytellers because of the way their sermons move. Movement is more important than structure because it's not going to be pictured on a camera. It's going to be heard by the ear. Now, a good story, if it fits and if it's appropriate, is powerful because it reminds most of the people in the house of something that happened to me when I was 9 years old. My father did that. I remember the church back home. And here, everybody then has something they want to say. And that's what good preaching does. It causes people to want to say something themselves. So it's a toss-up. But good preaching, if it dips into the qualities of storytelling, it's pretty close to the same power. I'd hate to come off in front of everybody saying a story was better than a sermon, but a good sermon seems like a good story.
This question comes from a Presbyterian pastor in Decatur, Illinois, Jim Montgomery. He asks, how do you specifically choose or create stories in your sermon preparation? And he also wanted to know specifically, what percentage of your stories would you say are based on your life? And is it okay to create stories, make them up?
There are several things I do. Number one is most of the stories that I tell grow out of observation, something that I observed, heard, watched, experienced. But I try not to be on camera myself, but hold the camera and the story on the other person. It may start off, I was in the airport the other day, but it moves to the other person. You don't want to make it too much. But when I have such an experience, talking with a child, visiting with a man on the street, something that happens in the sanctuary, in a home, wherever, all kinds of things, if it strikes me as having the quality of common human experience, it would cause somebody to say, that's exactly the way life is. I write it down in detail. It may be in a nursing home, it may be in a kindergarten. But the time and the place and who and what was said, I write it on one page, and I have notebooks of these. 75% of them never see the light of day, never occur in a sermon. But it enlarges my capacity to sympathize and empathize with people. So I preserve the stories. Very seldom do I tell a story that you read in a book or in another sermon or something like that. Now, it's tough to choose them. They choose themselves, more or less. But you have to have a stock of material out of on which you draw coming into the sermon. You don't want to sit there chewing your pencil or doodling with your machinery, saying, "Now I need a good story at this point." That's going to be a flop, a real flop. There will be experiences you've had, things you've observed that will say, "Let me in right here. I fit right in here." And you'll have a hard time keeping it out. I don't have any order or a catalog or subject arrangement of these stories. They're just there. And I reread them sometimes and mess up sometimes. But I don't believe you should avoid experiences you've had. But you have to believe it's not unique to you. People are not going to sit back and say, "Our pastor has some really unusual experiences every time he goes to the Fiji Islands," or something like that. It has to be out of the heart of life so people identify with it, whatever the source. And sometimes it's appropriate to create a story. I have it on good authority. Jesus created stories, parables. You have to put a tag on it. He put a tag on it. Which one of you, or once there was a certain man. Once you start that way, the listener says, "Parable." Well, if you start off, you want to put a tag on it. Let us suppose there were, if it were the case, some little tag that says "created." I usually insert an absurdity in a story so that everybody knows it's not fact, it's created. But the fact that it's created doesn't lessen the quality. You don't want it to be fakey, trying out stuff on the listeners. But experiences from life that you've observed that intrude themselves into your sermon, saying, "Now here's where I fit into your preaching." Otherwise, if you're grabbing for stories, you'll use one too soon or too late. You use it too soon because, that's a good story, and you put it in a sermon. And then a month later, there's a good place where it would have fit, but it's too late. You've already used it. It's a delicate piece of material.
Garrison Keillor is a great storyteller. Oh, yeah. Some say his monologues are rather like sermons to his flock, his listeners. Do you ever listen to Garrison?
Yes, I listen to Garrison Keillor, and I read Garrison Keillor. He is a master storyteller, and he has a keen moral sense and a keen ethical sense. He can sneak up on you with a story, and you think he's talking about hog killing time in Minnesota, but actually there's something about life and the sacredness of life that he's getting across. But he's the best I have heard. He's a sort of prose Burl Ives. I don't try to imitate him because he has the capacity to start a story that reminds him of another story that reminds him of another. Then he can come back to his original one. That's a little too much footwork for me. But I do admire it and respect him very much.
And along with that, humor is a key ingredient to an effective sermon, or can be. But what are some do's and don'ts about the use of humor in preaching?
I would recommend about close to 100% of the time not to tell jokes. Some people say, "I start off with a joke to get their attention." Most of the jokes that people start with, you've already heard. And it's a painful thing to look out and see by the expressions on the faces, "Reverend, we heard that already. What are you going to do, wait on the cross and tell it, or back out?" You're trapped. Besides that, a joke is a complete piece of material. It doesn't have any loose edges for you to tie into your sermon. It just starts, goes through, ends. Now what are you going to do? Clear your throat? How do you get anywhere from that? I don't recommend jokes. There's too much danger in it. But humor is a way of looking at life and the incongruities in life. Just slight touches. And it comes by feeling totally free. You can laugh at yourself and other people, and it's clearest evidence of the grace of God. You don't have any messianic feeling that the world is waiting for me and it's all up to me and all that heavy-footed pedestrian stuff. You stay light on your feet with a sense of humor. After all, God is God. I'm just here doing this the best I can. It's inevitable if you really believe in the freedom that comes from your faith and from your vocation. It'll come up all the time.
Are there ways that we should be careful about the use of other emotions in preaching?
Yeah, should be very, very careful. You don't want to be the only one in the house crying or the only one in the house laughing. You don't want to be laughing or crying about the wrong thing. It starts with knowing yourself. Some people are their emotions are very close to the surface. Mine are very close to the surface. In fact, sometimes I decide at the last minute not to tell something because it is so emotion-laden, so full of sorrow or grief or pain of some sort, that not only do I feel they're not ready for it to be heard, but I'm not ready to tell it. The ink isn't dry. And if I get in the middle of that and get emotional, I don't want to. I never add material after preparation in the pulpit, but I sometimes will extract something for the very reason of the availability of emotion. It is a delicate thing. You can violate people by hurting their feelings.
What would you say about ending the sermon?
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing. In my working, preparing a sermon, I do the conclusion first. I know where I'm going. And that saves me a lot of energy. I don't move through the sermon with my landing gear down wondering where I'm going to stop or ending two or three times and finally, no. But I want to give them the benefit of the doubt. I don't want to run past the goal line into the next field. I think you've been listening. I think you're interested in this. I think you believe in this as strongly as I do. So I'm going to leave you something to do. Quietly, prayerfully, or excitedly, or take up some task. I'm going to leave something for you. I more often make a mistake of stopping short of the goal line than I do going past it. But my respect for you is such that if I start a sentence that has been a refrain through the sermon, the last time I start that sentence, I may say one word and I know you'll complete it. But I always assume that everybody in the house, we know it's not true really, but everybody in the house knows this subject, is interested in this subject, believes like I believe, and is with me through the whole sermon and want me to do well. Now that's taken me a long time to get to that point. I used to be a little, you know, somebody get up and leave. What did I say wrong? And I was upset. Well, they may have had to catch a plane or go to the restroom. But I didn't give a positive regard to the listener like I do now. I trust that you will finish the sermon. Now, someone will come up and ask a question. I don't know if I really got what you were really saying. You may answer it at the door, or you may leave it with them. They deserve a little work, you know.
This question comes from Bill Carter, Presbyterian preacher and master jazz pianist, as many of us here at the festival know. He asks, as One Without Authority was published when preaching was a rather unpopular discipline in seminaries, and these are different times, for better or worse, how has your mind changed since the publication of that book? And what might that suggest to the ways that we shape our sermons today?
Well, that's a good question. I had to work through that question a couple of 3 years ago before I agreed to the re-release of that book. It started in 1971. And Bill is right, the scenery was different, the attitude in schools, and some schools didn't even offer homiletics, like that's a dead discipline. Now it's people are clamoring for good teachers of homiletics. So there is a positive regard. You don't have the same giants to battle. But much of the landscape of the American scene is like it was back in those days. The triumph of experience over tradition, the belief in, I don't want to, you know, multitasking, I'm real busy and this sort of thing. The use of technology and flashing things on the screen and taking out the hymnals and doing like that. So it's a radical transition time as it was then. I have thought through some things I talked about that I think are still valid. For instance, what constitutes good sentence, good composition, good movement in a message, the use of conversation within a sermon, imaginative language, primary use of words. All of those things stand the test of time. That book, however, was primarily devoted to the how of preaching. How do you do it? And I was trying to work off of everybody wants to quit, so how do we get new interest in it? The church was still interested. The ministers had lost interest. If I were doing it again, I would devote more attention to the what of preaching, because there are people going in droves, sitting before pulpits and screens and other media, but they don't know what they believe. They have a sort of flavor of, I think I believe, but maybe I just believe in belief. The fear also that if I believe something strongly, I've become exclusive, as though others didn't have anything. I would spend a lot of time with the what. But you can't talk about everything in the same book. You try to put the grease where the squeak is, and in 1971, it was on the how. I think the time has come when preachers need to give more attention to what they're saying. That would be the big shift. So if you see Bill, tell him that's what he needs to do.
It has to be somewhat gratifying for you to have seen that shift back to an interest in seminaries to teach preaching again, and to see the interest, say, at conferences such as this. Surely you played a role in that resurgence, but what do you think about that?
Well, I'm pleased about it. I wonder about it because it is so extraordinary. I mean, David Howell has put together an event that draws over 1,000, maybe 1,200 ministers, all ethnic groups, all denominations, where you have a combination of very good preaching, all kinds of styles, plus presentations about preaching and the latest cutting edge thing, you know. And it's just so overwhelming. It's like sitting down to a banquet when you've been on bread and water. You can overindulge or OD on homiletics for a weekend. And the persons who go, the times I have been, I frankly admit that sometimes I have to skip out and walk around the block, because if I've heard an extraordinary sermon, I don't want to immediately hear another sermon. I don't care if it's Paul preaching. I'm just going to sit this one out and listen to the tape. You have to take the measure of your own capacity. When are you full? Right now, the feast is great. The banquet is great. We want to be good stewards of the resources. And that's why anything that turns so radically, I think, what's causing this? I welcome it, yeah.
What would you say is the most egregious mistake preachers make?
I don't know. I think it's ministers think, if I read one more book or listen to one more lecture or go hear one more preacher, I'll come up with a style that's really effective. And not being patient enough to find your own voice. There comes a time when you have to quit reading sermons and listening to sermons and preach. Otherwise, you're surrounded by all the instruments in the orchestra, and you don't know what instruments you play. It was not till I accepted the fact that I'm a piccolo and don't have to try to be a bass drum or a trombone or anything else. I really couldn't make any progress at all. So if you have been called to preach, you've been called to instrumentation of the message in a certain way, unique to you. So find that. Not be in a hurry to be like this one or that one, or eating off other people's plate. I'm not talking about plagiarism. I'm just talking about a lot of good stuff, and I don't know what to do with it, so I'll just bring it in. And the people ask, who are you? I mean, Jesus I know and Paul I know, but who are you? Deal with that quite early, I think, is important.
How do you find your own voice? Do you find it in the doing, in the preaching, or are there ways that we can kind of discover our own unique instrument?
I think you discover it in the doing. I've turned some corners in trying to find a way to do it. As you may have noticed, I'm short. I have a weak voice. Don't have high energy level, not full of excitement and all the things that go with it. All the preachers I listened to growing up in the church were full of thunder and lightning. All of them were 9 feet tall and loud and energetic. And then I sound like the wind whistling through a splinter on a post. And I just thought, how can I compensate for what I don't have? So I built a lot of detours and developed some compensations. But in the course of it, I found that people heard me. They heard what I said and wanted to talk about it more. Or could you suggest something I could read? Then I knew that I was communicating. I have never wanted to be a great speaker. I just wanted to be heard in the literal sense and symbolic sense. But you find that in doing. Like Albert Schweitzer said, the way you get to know Jesus is by following him. I think it's true in preaching.
You've talked a little bit about this in some of your answers, but do you have particular sermon preparation methods that you would advocate?
Well, I have two basic stages of operation. One is getting something to say. I'm not getting up a sermon, I'm getting a message, which I hope I can state by the end of my preparation in one clear, positive sentence. And then the second stage is to make what I have discovered into a sermon. And that calls a little art and craft. But the first part is just deadly research, getting something to say. Now, when young ministers start out, for instance, you see a young minister in the library, books open all around. What are you doing? I'm getting up a sermon. No. Find something to say, well-researched, and when you know clearly what you want to say, then begin to work on a sermon. And let a little time lapse in between the rough sketch of what I want to say and the way I'm going to say it. And I do that still after all these years.
Obviously, pastors can be very busy people. There can be surprises during the week. So if a preacher is really up against a deadline in their preparation for a sermon, what do you suggest if they haven't had time to really prepare as they'd like to?
Well, that's a common experience, I think, but not as common as many ministers would think. I very seldom meet a minister who doesn't have time. He may have 9 funerals and 14 weddings that week. Now, that's exceptional. But most of the time when we don't have enough time to get a sermon this week because I've been so busy, is I probably am not well organized and well disciplined. But let's give the benefit of the doubt. Two things could be done. Several. One is say to the people, I have been busy. As you know, we've had this and this and this and this. And instead of wasting your time, what I would like to do is to read to you a sermon on the subject that I wanted to deal with, preached by Harry Emerson Fosdick 35 years ago. I think you'll find it appropriate. Just be honest. Secondly, drag out an older sermon that you could nurse a little bit, manipulate, bring it back to life. And you may want to tell them that's what you did. Or you may stand up and read scripture and some appropriate poetry or this and that. But I think you can, even at the last minute, prepare something appropriate and effective to say, because you've been well-disciplined and you've been preparing sermons week by week for years. You have a reservoir. You have something you can draw on. You can think of something to say, and it'll be a pretty good sermon. In fact, somebody will say, that's your best one yet. And don't believe them. Don't believe them, otherwise you'll be in the barrel every week. But there's a lot of truth to it. If you have a reservoir, and something is coming, like Sunday morning, and this is happening in the church, it'll be a magnet. It'll pull it out, and you'll be more ready. You may feel inadequate, but for the ear of the listener, you're more than adequate. I would trust that to be the case.
Your successor at Candler, Tom Long, wrote an article in the Christian Century a couple of years ago now on plagiarism in sermons, and it got quite a lot of response. I think surprising to him was the fact that a lot of preachers were defending the practice.
Yeah.
And you talked about being honest and using sermons, but giving credit and explaining that. But do you have any further thoughts about the issue of plagiarism in sermons?
Yeah, we're dealing, you know, with a matter of degrees, because I'm a part of all I ever met and read. And for instance, I spent years studying and for 4 years taught Shakespeare. And sometimes there'll be a line from Shakespeare or a stanza from his sonnet or something like that. And I don't even know that I did it, and I don't footnote it. Well, it can happen with something else. So it's a matter of degrees. If it is common public domain material, no problem. But if you preached an extraordinary sermon in Richmond, Virginia, and I was there, but none of my folk were there, then I think I can get away with it. You're on thin ice. You don't get away with it because you know what you're doing. And we don't want to get engaged in anything that dulls the edge of our appetite for preaching or our ability to preach. I don't want to look around in the room and wonder, is anybody here who's heard this before? It's not only embarrassing, it's painful. And it's unnecessary. It's so unnecessary. Yeah.
What about using notes? What do you say about the use of notes in preaching?
I think every preacher ought to be skilled at preaching with manuscript, with notes, or with no notes. And some occasions call for it. If you're on a controversial issue, you should have full manuscript and walk out there and lay it open in such a way ostentatiously so that everybody says, uh-oh, this must be really big. He's got the manuscript there. They may want copies. Somebody may say, you said, no, yeah, you didn't say that. Here it is. Read it. I didn't say that. Other times you need some notes because there's a lot of tiptoeing and maneuvering in the sermon to get through it. But usually, if you prepare for delivery rather than for writing, you will know it by the time you get through preparing. And you don't need those notes. You want to have a maximum content with a minimal loss of contact with the listener. You'll have to work the formula out. But I would not in any way want anybody to believe that you sort of graduate, starting off with manuscript, I'm totally dependent on it, then I move to notes, then I move to no notes, look, Ma, no notes. That's not the way it works. A preacher ordinarily without notes sometimes should have the whole thing written out. You will know which is best at the time.
This is an election year, and several people want to know, should preachers talk about that? And if so, how?
Well, there's some things that I say about election year things. One is, urge people to exercise a freedom that your brothers and sisters in the Roman Empire at the time of the New Testament didn't have anything to say, were not heard, had no voice, no vote, anything. And they acted courageously, but the only thing left to them was rebellion. You have a chance for changing things by voting. If you don't vote, then don't talk about it. I urge them also, where is it that the gospel meets the community at large? What are the things that Jesus would have us talk about? And therefore, we want some candidate who has the same passion about those issues. I do not mention candidates in particular or party, political party in particular. Some people may try to guess by the issues I think are very, very important concerning care for people. I think the primary function of government is to care for people who can't care for themselves. And I talk about that, but I don't say, so let's all go down and vote for X or Y.
You could get into trouble for that.
Yeah.
Who are some of your favorite preachers? Who do you listen to?
Well, I was afraid you'd ask me that. There was a time when I had favorite preachers. because I had opportunity to, I was teaching, I would go hear great preachers, and there have been a lot of great preachers, but most of my favorite preachers, I'm sorry to say, are dead. Joseph Sittler of Chicago, unbelievably strong preacher. William Sloan Coffin. When Bill Coffin prepared, sometimes he was on the run and didn't stop long enough at his desk. He knows that, I've told him. But when he prepared, he was the best preacher in this country. The mixing of a simple evangelical message of God's love with let's get out there and get it done. He was just extraordinary. The preachers that I have read through the years are ancient, before my lifetime. Fred W. Robertson, I think the greatest preacher probably in the English language. Second, I would put John Donne. Tedious, long sermons, but just read them. It is unbelievable. There are good preachers now, but the preachers I listen to, Peter, are beginning or lay speakers, because I work with non-seminary trained ministers in the mountains in little churches, full of passion, full of sense of call, but not much education. Now, I run into a lot of theology that doesn't satisfy me, but there you have just raw passion that God has called me to say this to you people, if I can work with him. But sometimes I listen to a sermon that has all kinds of things wrong with it, and I'm deeply moved. It's the same way when I taught. Some students teetering on the edge, wondering whether or not this is for me, preaching the first sermon ever in history. Whew, sometimes they were really, really good. I used to worry and was hesitant about teaching preaching because I was afraid maybe I would lose the ear for preaching. After you listen to a few thousand, been there and done that. But it never has happened to me. I hear really good preaching now. And I heard recently an extraordinary sermon by a minister who was physically and visually challenged. Awful to look at, difficult to follow, and had thick glasses, could hardly read. But moving sermon on Abraham was called the friend of God. And it was unbelievable. I think he was Nazarene. Maybe Pentecostal, I don't know. I just had a little time to kill to catch the plane. Is there a church by here? There's one right down the corner, a little church. I went. I'm sort of in the habit of going to church. It was unbelievable. And what I'm saying may be avoiding your question. I don't want to start listing my favorite people that are contemporaries because once I do that, then they're spoiled and they can't preach anymore. So I won't do that.
Well, we'll blame that question on David Howell.
Also. David Howell, he's up to that stuff.
Should there be a distinction between the pastor's personal spiritual life and their sermon preparation, or should sermon preparation be a spiritual discipline?
I think sermon preparation is a spiritual discipline. When I began, my devotional life, whatever I read, biblical or otherwise, was one thing. My study was something else. And then Rabbi Silberman told me once at Vanderbilt, an hour at study is in the sight of the Holy One, blessed be He, as an hour of prayer. And I discovered that my study was drawing me closer to the message and to the heart of God than this little devotional book I had that didn't have 9 calories in the whole thing. And I discovered through experience the blending of my devotional life and my study life so that they're essentially the same anymore. Yeah.
How did you become a preacher? What was your calling? How did you get into the preaching business?
I had a calling, but it was a matter of connecting a lot of dots. I didn't have anything clear. I had no vision. I had no voice. I had no real strong support. My mother wanted me to be a minister, but it was not until I had accepted a call to preach that she told me she did, because she didn't want me to do it because of her. I didn't have any models, but somehow the way the human condition struck me as a West Tennessee Southern boy, the economic as well as racial, other tensions And I just thought, the church needs to say something. Maybe I need to say something. Maybe I was called. I may come to the end of the line and discover I was not called. I don't really care. I has no dream, no prophet's ecstasy, no sudden rending of the veil of clay, just something to say. If that was a call, I'm real pleased. I believe it was, but it was not dramatic.
If a miracle happened and preachers all across the country were truly empowered by the Holy Spirit and that affected their preaching, what do you think would be happening? What would they be saying or doing? What would their parishioners be hearing?
Preachers would be out with the people more, putting their lives where they were. They would be, walking the walk as well as talking the talk. The quality of preaching would be more passionate, and that's where the contagion is. If you start talking to me about something that's so important to you, it is gripping to you, I can't get away from it. We would not be whispering. We would be from the housetop shouting the message. And then we'd be out there talking what we say out of the pulpit as well. Pulpit is one place the sermon gets spoken. But take parts of it, all of it, to hospitals, civic meetings, PTA meetings, whatever. Use little pieces of your sermon all through the week. Multiply its influence. I think we would be raising people's questions, you know. So that's what church is really about. Well, I never thought about it that way. I think it could happen. As your question implies, it would have to be the work of the Holy Spirit. Otherwise, we'd try to think up clever ways. And we have more ways to communicate now than we have things to say. So we don't need more ways.
Fred, if you could be in Minneapolis with all these preachers, what's the one thing that you would want to communicate to them, the one thing that you'd want them to know or to do?
Establish a disciplined pattern of preparation of sermons and study in preparation for all your work. Same time of day in the same room, 6 days a week. And regret the days when emergencies call you away from that routine and be anxious about returning to it. The best friend the preacher has is habit. It means getting control of your own life. It's one thing to serve God, but you don't want to be picked to pieces by everybody in the community and in the congregation. Let your presence grow out of absence. Let your speaking grow out of silence. You have to be in charge of your own schedule. Discipline and habit. That's where it starts.
Dr. Fred Craddock, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.